Hello and welcome to Science World. Elizabeth Lee will tell us about an unusual organism that breathes rocks. Carol Pearson reports that doctors may soon have a more reliable way to diagnose prostate cancer. And we'll hear about the recent discovery of an extrasolar object that is encircled by a system of rings 200 times larger than those surrounding Saturn. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. More than two decades ago, scientists discovered an organism that can breathe rocks. Since then, others that could eat or get energy out of rocks have been found. Elizabeth Lee has a report about these unusual organisms.
Kenneth Nielsen can be described in many ways, including expert in microbiology and biochemistry. But that's not the one he is most proud of.
People call me the father of Shewanella.
Shewanella is an unusual bacterium that shocked the scientific community. Nielsen discovered it 25 years ago in a lake. Like other organisms, it breathes oxygen, but it also breathes rock. Nielsen looks at a time-lapse video of the Shewanella breathing rock. It shows a piece of manganese oxide slowly disappearing over several hours.
That particle that you saw disappear before your eyes in 18 hours, under those conditions, should have been stable for thousands of years.
All living things, including people, make energy through what's called electron transfer. It involves taking electrons from the food we eat.
When we breathe in oxygen, we give electrons to it, and it's that voltage that allows us to make energy.
This process usually happens internally, but for the Shewanella and other mineral-breathing organisms, the electron transfer happens outside the cell. When the process was first discovered, it seemed impossible to the scientific community.
This was one of the most exciting times in my career, when you realize that you have something that probably no one else has, and that almost no one's going to believe.
Since then, microbiologists have found other organisms that breathe metal, and Nielsen says they are finally making it into science textbooks. Building on Nielsen's work, one researcher in his lab, Annette Rowe, just made another discovery. Bacteria that eat rock in ocean sediments as an energy source and transfer electrons from outside the cell membrane into the cell.
So you don't actually have to internalize it to get energy from it.
It's going to be as wacky as the 15 years ago, 25 years ago. Because you could see from the reviews of this that some people just didn't believe it. Okay, and they didn't want to believe it.
These findings have implications that extend to outer space and how life might exist on a planet like Mars. Nielsen says one of his former students is now building this instrument that will attach to the arm of a rover and give scientists a special set of eyes on the 2020 Mars mission.
If you picked up a nice fluorescent signal from a Mars rock or a sediment or a core, if we could drill into it, and all of a sudden you saw certain colors of fluorescence, you would say, well, stop the train, let's get a sample of this and look at it in more detail.
Meanwhile, scientists are drilling into the lower parts of the Earth's crust, several kilometers down, to see if there are forms of life there, living in ways much different than what we know as life on the surface. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
A new study shows that doctors may soon have a more reliable way to diagnose prostate cancer. Carol Pearson tells us more.
Prostate cancer seems to run in Ronald Briscoe's family.
My older brother, my father had it, and also my baby brother has it.
Family history has a lot to do with a man's chances of getting an aggressive type of prostate cancer. One study shows if a man's male relatives had it, his risk could be up to 3 times higher than normal. Unlike breast cancer, which can be found with a mammogram using a low dose of radiation, advanced imaging is not normally used to diagnose prostate cancer. Doctors use ultrasound to guide them as they take tissue samples of the prostate. Ultrasound uses sound waves, a safer technology than radiation, but Dr. Peter Pinto from the National Cancer Institute says it falls short of what doctors need.
Ultrasound ensures that the needles hit the prostate, but we don't use the ultrasound to direct the needles into where the tumor may be present.
Dr. Manoj Siddiqui says biopsies guided by ultrasound are hit or miss.
They randomly try to get all the prostate sample in hopes of catching the cancer.
In contrast, an MRI uses a magnetic field and radio waves to give a detailed picture of part of the body.
MRI can tell us where tumors are hiding in the prostate. It's not normally sampled.
That's how Ronald Briscoe's cancer was found. He participated in a large study at the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Siddiqui led the study, which involved 1,000 men at high risk for prostate cancer. One group had a biopsy using both ultrasound and MRI technology. The other group had standard ultrasound-guided biopsies. Dr. Pinto was one of the co-authors.
The targeted MR-guided biopsy had a 30% increase in detection of high-risk prostate cancer as compared to the traditional biopsies performed today.
Dr. Siddiqui plans more clinical trials, but he says the results of this preliminary study are promising.
The benefit of doing that is that we maximize our ability to detect the high-risk cancers that matter and also potentially avoid the harm of detecting cancer which is clinically insignificant and unlikely to cause problems for the patient.
The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
British scientists say they are close to creating applications for our smartphones that will make it possible to send taste, smell, and even a basic touch. George Putich reports.
Many people around the world enjoy one of the greatest marvels of modern technology every day, instant audio-visual communication. But Professor Adrian David Chalk from City University in London says he wants to transcend what he calls the glass barrier.
In the real world, we can open up the glass, open the window, and we can touch, we can taste, we can smell in the real world.
Let's start with the sense of taste. Chalk says different tastes are triggered by molecules that cause chemical ionization of the surface of the tongue, sending the brain electrical signals of a specific amplitude and frequency that are possible to reproduce with two electrodes.
You put these two silver electrodes in your mouth, you put your tongue in between, and then it stimulates electrically your tongue and you get a virtual taste perception in your brain.
So far, scientists have reproduced sour, salty, sweet, and bitter tastes. Another device called Senti plugs into a smartphone and can spray tiny clouds of selected fragrances, such as lavender or jasmine, smells of fruits, or even coffee, when prompted by the other side of the conversation.
Basically, what happens is we have an app, it connects to the internet, and then this will release a scent from your mobile phone.
Senti holds a cartridge with around 100 different smells, but when used up, has to be replaced. The sense of touch comes through a ring-like device. Connected wirelessly to the smartphone, it transmits a gentle squeeze when the other person does the same during a conversation.
I can be in London and my friend can be in Tokyo and I can squeeze my finger and then they'll get a squeeze on their finger through the internet. It's a way of touch communication with small mobile devices.
Chalk says he hopes devices such as these will someday be added to smartphones and even smart houses, transcending the current limitations of long-distance communication. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
In a few minutes, we'll hear about an object outside our solar system that is surrounded by a ring system 200 times larger than those circling Saturn. While Saturn has the largest ring system in our solar system, it's not the only one with rings. Which of the following planets is also encircled by rings? A. Jupiter, B. Uranus, C. Neptune, or D. all three? A, B, and C. Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
NASA is wrapping up its busiest 12-month period in more than a decade, with three missions launched in 2014 and two in January. Roseanne Skirbel tells us that the missions are focused on Earth's vital life support systems and how they are responding to a warmer planet.
That several satellites would be ready to fly at roughly the same time was a remarkable confluence of events, says NASA Earth scientist Tom Wagner.
Satellites take a long time to build. You know, remember, once it goes to space, it's really hard to fix it. So a typical satellite could take anywhere from 3 to 6 years just to build.
The latest probes bring NASA's fleet of Earth-observing instruments to 18. First off the launch pad last February was GPM, short for Global Precipitation Measurement.
And what that's going to do is improve our understanding of precipitation. It'll be able to measure how much snow is in the atmosphere. And that'll overall improve our understanding of rainfall.
GPM was followed by the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, or OCO2. Wagner says this is important considering that the burning of fossil fuels from power plants, buildings, and transport are a primary driver of global warming.
One of the most important things with carbon dioxide is we need to know where it's coming from, but we need to know where it goes. Does it get taken up by the ocean, for example? Is it being released by thawing of the Arctic? And if we want to figure out where the planet's going to be, say, in 50 or 100 years, those are the kinds of processes we need to understand.
Also in the last year, two instruments were mounted on the International Space Station.
It's the first time we're putting instruments on the space station to look down at Earth. And the space station represents this incredible platform because it has things like a lot of power. It can handle large instruments with a lot of mass. It has a relatively limited orbit. You know, it's in an orbit that kind of always only covers like the middle part of the planet. It doesn't get the poles. But even from there, we can say quite a bit.
One instrument is called RapidSCAT. From its fixed position outside the station, it's documenting how fast winds are blowing on the surface of the ocean, providing data which can improve climate models and weather prediction. The other is known as CATS, or the Cloud Aerosol Transport System,
which is going to shoot lasers down into the atmosphere to look at the relationship between, like, pollutants and other particles in cloud formation.
The last satellite scheduled for liftoff this week is SMAP, or Soil Moisture Active Passive. It will collect data on Earth's water cycle critical to life on the planet. Wagner says SMAP and the other tools are a necessary checkup on the planet's vital systems.
And the simple fact is this, the Earth is all interconnected. And if you want to understand it, you need to make measurements all over the place all the time so you can get a total picture of what's going on. And satellites is one of the best ways to do that. They're going to go after things like precipitation. They're going to go after where is water. They're going to go after clouds, major components of the Earth system.
Wagner says special science teams analyze the vast archive of data streaming from satellites. The information benefits weather forecasters and informs climate models. NASA data also help farmers and ocean and land managers make better decisions in response to a warmer world. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
White House security was breached again this past week when a small, remote-controlled quadcopter crashed on its lawn. The U.S. Secret Service is investigating, but drone experts say there is no reliable way to protect against these now widely available devices. Science World's Bob Doty has this report from George Butich.
This was not the first incident of a flying machine on the grounds of the White House. In September 1994, a pilot crashed a small Cessna airplane into the South Lawn, prompting reevaluation of security procedures. But the latest incident again highlighted the increased vulnerability of the traditional home of the U.S. presidents. Thanks to advances in cheap electronics, lightweight materials, and mechanical parts, drones are now available to anyone. The Federal Aviation Administration, which regulates U.S. airspace, limits the flights of drones operated by hobbyists to a height of about 120 meters and within sight of the operator. But modern drones can be pre-programmed to fly automatically along so-called waypoints. According to Illinois Institute of Technology Robotics Lab Associate Professor Matthew Spenko, some manufacturers program their drones so they cannot be operated in certain areas, but the system is not immune to hacking.
If you're smart enough and you know what you're doing, you can always override that.
Spenko says quadcopters can carry up to 6 kilograms of payload. The best among them can stay airborne for 25 minutes and fly as fast as 10 meters per second. University of Nebraska journalism professor Matthew Waite studies how drones can be used to report news. He says this week's incident may have some bad consequences.
I've been saying for years that it's going to take one idiot doing something stupid to trigger a lot of bad policy, and I'm afraid that we may have found our idiot.
Waite says the White House is well protected, but a motivated person can still create a lot of chaos.
If somebody wants to cause harm and havoc with a device and some explosives, there's very little to stop them. And that's just kind of the way of the world.
The Secret Service does not have a reliable system to identify and disable drones. After the latest incident, Waite says the agency will no doubt reconsider its options, but he thinks the danger from drones is small.
Could you do damage with it? Absolutely. Are you going to level a building with it? No, probably not. So, sure, there's a threat here, but it's, in the grand scheme of other threats, I think it's pretty low.
Much as other modern devices, drones are here to stay. So governments and regulators will have to come up with comprehensive regulations to control their use. In the meantime, private companies are already seeing the potential for a lucrative business. Devices that protect us from drones. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Saturn is surrounded by the largest ring system in our solar system, but it's not the only one with rings. Which of the following planets also has rings? A. Jupiter, B. Uranus, C. Neptune, or D. all three, A, B, and C? The answer is D. All three of these gas giant planets, along with Saturn, are encircled with rings. While scientists have long known about Saturn's rings, it wasn't until the last several decades that ring systems were discovered around those other gas planets. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
One of our solar system's most fascinating planets is Saturn. What makes Saturn stand out from the others, of course, is the dazzling system of rings that surround it. This past week, a pair of astronomers announced that they have discovered a celestial body outside of our solar system that they refer to as a super Saturn. That's because the object is surrounded by a ring system 200 times as large as those that circle Saturn. The astronomers are still trying to determine whether the ringed object, dubbed J1407b, is an actual planet or a brown dwarf, something that was supposed to be a star but wasn't able to sustain the needed hydrogen-1 fusion to make it a full-fledged star. Dr. Eric Mamajek, an astronomer from the University of Rochester in New York, along with Matthew Kenworthy of the Netherlands Leiden Observatory, made the discovery after analyzing data gathered from the UK's extrasolar planet detection program called SuperWASP. Dr. Mamajek joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about this newfound super Saturn. Can you tell us about what your team found back in 2012?
We had actually not originally intended to look for this. This was a serendipitous discovery. We had found hundreds of young sun-like stars a few hundred light years from Earth, and we were studying these sun-like stars. And we noticed that the brightness of one of them, as measured by a couple robotic telescopes from the survey called SuperWASP, a UK program, we noticed that this star was flickering on and off over 2 months in their data from 2007. And in December 2010, my graduate student Mark Pico had walked into my office with a printout showing this light curve, and we couldn't explain it. We were in awe of it. Anyway, it took about a year for us to try to piece together what was going on with this star. And so the picture that's emerged is we're dealing with a young sun-like star. It's very similar to our sun, but only about 15 million years old. And it looks like it has a giant planet or a failed star, dubbed J1407b, that has this huge ring system that's passed in front of the star. And nothing like this has ever been seen before. This is the changes in the brightness of the star was just crazy over these 2 months. And we've explored lots of different ideas on what could be producing these variations, but the only model that really explains all the data is having something like a giant planet that has this huge array of dense rings around it.
As you and your team were observing this ringed exoplanet, you noticed a series of unusual eclipses. Can you tell us about these eclipses and the role they played in making your discovery?
They were very deep. I mean, that was the thing that first caught our eye. I mean, at their deepest, about 95% of the star's light was blocked out. And this was going on for days. So, you know, one day you might see the light blocked out 40%, then the next day it might be 60%, and then increasing, and the next day it might be 70%, decreasing. And we just saw these variations. Every night the star was doing something different. And what this latest paper is showing is our best model is that this object, a Jupiter-like planet or failed star orbiting this object, this star, J1407, and that object itself has this huge system of rings around it. And it does a pretty nice job of fitting the data.
A new analysis of data led by your colleague Matthew Kenworthy from the Netherlands provided a bit more detail on this ring system.
Well, we're seeing the structure in the rings in much greater detail. So our original paper in 2012, our first attempt at this, we had a model that included four rings, but it did an okay job fitting the data, but not that great. And this latest model has over 30 rings in the model. What it looks like is we're now seeing very clean gaps in some places. It looks like there's very abrupt changes in the density of these rings. And if you look at Saturn's rings, whenever you see these gaps, that indicates that there's a moon there. There's either a moon in the gap, carving out the ring and making the gap, or there's a moon even further out or closer in that is gravitationally perturbing it. But one way or another, you need some small objects in this system to carve out these sort of features. The gaps we see are very clean, so there must be something in there that's gobbling up the material or dynamically throwing it out of the system.
Do you and your colleagues see this ring system as material to form exomoons? And if so, do you see the rings then completely disappearing?
I think what we're actually seeing is a proto-exosatellite disk, maybe called a circumplanetary disk. We see ring systems around the giant planets in our solar system, but they're very low mass. They're very confined within a few hundred thousand kilometers of their planets. I think what we're actually seeing here is the stage where moons are actually forming.
I understand that amateur astronomers are contributing to your research.
If amateur astronomers want to help, we're looking for the next eclipse. So I would hope that there'd be some interest among amateur astronomers in monitoring this system, because who knows, they may see the next eclipse before we do. We've actually had some amateur astronomers contribute data already to the project. So there's a large body of amateur astronomers called the American Association of Variable Star Observers, the AAVSO, and people monitor stars that are changing in brightness, and they report the brightnesses of those stars to the AAVSO. And we've included some astronomers that have contributed observations in our papers. We don't know when the next eclipse is going to take place. That's really going to help characterize this system further, is when we actually see a second eclipse. And we're monitoring the star, but we need other people to monitor the star too.
That was Dr. Eric Mamajek from the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.